Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week, one Utah lawmaker wants to expand capital punishment, even as more states vote to abolish the death penalty. We'll hear about the proposal to add child sex trafficking to the list of capital crimes. We'll also get the latest on the prison move, including one option in Tooele County dropping out of the running, and a lawsuit over a possible site in Saratoga Springs. And the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control gets dinged by another audit. We'll hear more about how to fix the DABC. The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines, coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got the death penalty, prison sites, the BLM, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, senior political reporter Robert Gerke is here. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning to you. Also with us, columnist Paul Raleigh. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Health, Education, and Environment Editor. We need to condense your title.
Easier.
Pretty much she does everything. Rebecca Walsh, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And investigative reporter Matt Canham is with us as well. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
And you can join us, too, with your questions and comments about the week's news. Send those to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter. Put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us live. 801-355-TALK is that number. Matt, I'm going to start with you. A few developments on a proposed prison move to a new location this week. First, the Larry H. Miller family withdrew its property from consideration on the site list. Why?
That's a good question, and I think the way the Miller family would say it is that they weren't really actively pushing for the state to buy on their land, but they would like to consider it. And, well, they considered it and decided they didn't want to sell their land now. They want to develop it in another way. And they did this. There was a middleman who was a state legislator, Representative Sagers from Tooele County, quietly brokered conversations between the Prison Relocation Commission and the family over the last 2 weeks. And the point was made that this land could be used for other things and that the community really, really doesn't want a prison right next to their community center where the kids swim in the pool and they play soccer in the soccer fields. They didn't want to see a prison next door to it. And from what Representative Sager said, who is the one who's talking for the family publicly, is that that backlash actually played a role in the decision to withdraw their land. And now they're going to look at other options, and those options are still pretty vast. It could be manufacturing. It could be what the county commissioners want is this mixed-use retail, housing, little shopping area. You know, the interesting part of all this is that when the county leaders and the opposition groups talk about why they don't want a prison there, they often talk about access to water, which is a big issue and was an issue in this case as well, because the Millers don't own water rights on the land big enough to put a prison there. And the state was having a hard time finding someone to put water there because Grantsville and Tooele County, their city councils have already voted to say, we're not providing water for a prison. So the cities weren't going to do it. They needed to find their own land, water sites or water rights, and they have a deadline. The state's going to make this decision in August. So if they can't lock up water, you can't build there. So that made it so the Prison Relocation Commission from their side, they had at this point five sites to choose from. And they were privately telling the family, you're probably number five. So if the community hates it and the commission's probably not going to pick you and you have other options, go with the other options.
And there was much rejoicing in Tooele County, right?
Yes, they were. They're thrilled, especially because Tooele County's kind of taken some lumps lately. They got Stericycle from Davis County's moving down there, and which is the Burns Medical Waste. And then you have the Miller Motorsports Park, which is also the Miller family. They've decided not to renew their lease in October, which is a big hit for the county. So they've taken some lumps. This was a nice move, and the county leaders and the residents there were pretty happy about it.
That leaves four sites.
Right.
We've talked about this before, but briefly, can you remind our listeners where these sites are?
Sure. Let's stay in Tooele County. There is one site still there, and that is right behind the Walmart Distribution Center in Grantsville. It's on a little bit on a slope. This is the one closest to homes. In Utah County, there's two. There's one at the very northern end of Eagle Mountain. If people have visited Eagle Mountain, it's a very fast-growing bedroom community west of Utah Lake. This is about, I'm going to do this off the top of my head, so the number might not be exactly right, but it's about 3 or 4 miles south of where homes are. But those homes are stretched in that direction in a hurry. And then west of that is a very small town called Fairfield. It has 150 people. This would be a prison right outside of it. This would be a 4,000-bed prison. So the population of Fairfield would go from 150 to 4,150 very fast. And then the last one is west of the airport. It's about 5 miles west of Salt Lake International Airport, at land that part of it is owned by Kennecott, the copper mine, and the other part's owned by a family in California that runs a winery. I don't know how they got the land, but they jointly own sections that are under consideration. And so those are the four sites.
Okay. There was a public meeting. They're doing a series of information meetings.
Yes.
There was another one last night. I believe it was in Grantsville.
That's right.
And our colleague Courtney Tanner attended. What happened?
You know, this is the second one. The first one was in Salt Lake, which has the least organized opposition group. They oppose it, but they're not as boisterous. And that's pretty much exactly what played out. The Salt Lake one was kind of stayed. This one was not. This crowd, when they got the answers they didn't like, booed, overshouted, you know, the people who were speaking. They wanted to make the point of just how much they oppose this. And part of the reason they did that is because this was a question and answer, but you didn't get to directly ask your question. They were written down, filtered, as a way to lower the temperature in the room. Well, the groups know that, so they had a week to prepare. They decided we're gonna be far more demonstrative. They had people who had duct tape over their mouths, and they had people who were running around with big signs, and they made it uncomfortable for the Prison Relocation Commission, who stood up there. Now, it seems like you get a lot of the same questions at these things. People are worried about safety. They don't want to see that in their neighborhood. And those are questions that you can understand, and that the people who are trying to move the prison say doesn't really make sense in a modern correctional facility. The chance of a breakout in a new facility is just tiny. And even in our old jail, which has been around some of it for, 50, 60 years, we haven't had a breakout in decades. So, but it's human nature to worry about your kids when you have a facility of people who should not, the state has determined should not be allowed to be in the public for a while.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a lot of the questions.
Raleigh, as you watch this process move forward, any observations? I mean, will the withdrawal of the Miller site, what effect do you think that's going to have on the process?
Well, I don't know if that what that tips to, if it tips to any other. What I would say about it is this is a shining example of representative government in Utah. Look at the people who you represent. And then you take the opposite position of what they want. It seems like there's so much. It's funny to me that they don't spend more time thinking about maybe about the idea of keeping it in Draper, which I mean there's a big push from a lot of people for that. Wherever they move to is going to be very expensive. The Eagle Mountain one was interesting to me. I mean, everybody in Eagle Mountain, is opposed to having the prison there, except for like one guy and their senator down there, Mark Madsen. That seems to be his constituent that he cares about, and nobody else. But so, I mean, it's just to me an example of they've made up their mind. They've made up their mind behind closed doors. They'll probably, and what the actual people who are going to be affected want doesn't matter.
Is that your assessment, Robert? I mean, what's the chatter on the Hill? Obviously, a lot of people who are living in these communities have a heightened awareness and a lot of passion around this issue. Mm-hmm. Do fellow lawmakers also share that, or do they feel like this is a decision that's now out of our hands and it's in the community?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of, I don't know if it's monolithic necessarily. As Paul mentioned, there are representatives, Representative Sagers, for example, who's been very opposed to moving it and to and to moving it, especially to Tooele County. So, but by and large, I think the sentiment is that, yeah, we need to move this. I mean, we've seen the legislature take action several times now on to sort of endorse moving forward with the relocation. We've seen the governor express support for it, although he has also said he's open to leaving it there if that's the right decision. You know, and I just think I think the question of whether to move it or not is a question that's largely been answered for representatives and for, you know, those in government, and now it's the question is where.
Matt, you had another story this week, another development in the prison move, a lawsuit over one of the potential prison sites. It's now off the table in Saratoga Springs, but right. Fill us in. What's the story?
Josh Romney, the son of Mitt Romney, the former presidential candidate and current Utah resident, had a group of developers who bought some land in outside of Saratoga Springs and very close to Camp Williams. And they thought this would be a great land for the prison, so they pitched it to the state. The state looked at it. They put it on the short list in December. And Saratoga Springs got very upset. Camp Williams wasn't very happy about it. And when you looked at the land, it kind of has some geological features that made it hard to find the appropriate space for a prison. There was actually kind of like a gully in it, which would be hard to, you know, it'd make it more complicated than it needed to be. So what ended up happening was Josh Romney and his friends who created Western States Ventures struck a deal with Saratoga Springs to put houses there. And they got a annexation deal and a development deal that was lightning fast for such a massive development. And it abuts a gravel mine. And they, when they did this lightning fast deal, they changed the zoning at the gravel mine from industrial to agriculture.
That guy's not happy.
You can't blast rock into gravel on agriculture land. And so he's suing, saying this violates, you know, the law. You guys move too fast. This is a bad deal. And you're killing my business that I just invested in. Western States Ventures is going to fight it. Saratoga Springs, they're not backing down. They're saying we have the right to change the zoning and we can do what we want. What the mine owner wants is a 2,000-foot blast zone where he can still do what he's doing, where it won't be a huge problem for the homes that are built closer. Western States wants to build homes closer. There's definitely some bad blood there that I don't know exactly where it started, but there's some serious tension between the mine owner and these land owners. So it's going to be something to watch going forward. Josh Romney is pretty active in some development issues, and this is a big one.
Mm-hmm. Fill us in on the last informational meeting. I think it's coming up this week.
It's June 2nd, actually, and it's in Eagle Mountain. And so it's going to be one that covers both the Eagle Mountain and Fairfield sites. And those ones have different issues than the ones in Tooele County or Salt Lake. In Salt Lake, it was about wetlands. In Tooele County, it's about water. In Eagle Mountain, it's going to be about development. It's going to be about how fast is this area going to grow, and do you want it to be just like Draper in so many years from now? That's the argument from people who don't want it there, which includes the mayor, state representative, the entire city council, and most of the residents. So that's going to be the issue there. That's June 2nd. In Eagle Mountain.
Okay, we'll continue to follow that story. Let's turn to liquor, shall we? State auditors took yet another look at the Utah Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, the DABC, this time assessing how it's managed. And Robert, just briefly, what do they find?
Well, it's a little early to be talking about liquor.
It is a little early.
So the auditor has, and this is sort of the latest in a series of audits that have come out on DABC. But the auditor was looking at whether the agency was really being run like a business. I mean, the concept behind the state liquor agency is that, you know, it's supposed to function like a business with these retail stores. And so what the auditor found was essentially that, you know, the management that is making the decisions on these things don't really have a business background. They don't really have experience outside of the running this state agency. He also found that there's some issues that should probably they could improve their sort of their inventory control. There are things that, you know, they're not necessarily keeping track of data over a long enough period of time, so they don't know what sells well in different periods. And so, you know, in the audit, you know, to kind of put it into context, I guess, the audit comes at a time where DABC has been under a little bit of fire. I mean, they've recently had to cut $500,000 from their budget, even though they're generating tens of millions of dollars every year in revenues. And, you know, they've received criticism both from former employees who say that the management is sort of run amok, and those who, you know, sort of like Senator Karen Maine, who are just they want these issues fixed, and they see it as an agency that's just poorly run. So they've got their hands full with this. I mean, the agency agreed that they could do more to sort of make sure that their top management has, you know, the adequate training that's needed. And so they're trying to proceed with that. The other issue that they're facing, and this wasn't actually covered in the audit, is sort of this employee turnover. If you're talking about, because this did just look at sort of the management side of it, the employees that are on sort of on the front lines, the ones who actually sell you the booze, mm-hmm. they're poorly paid, and there's now with the economy improving, there's the turnover at a lot of these stores is 100%. So if you go into a store one day, the person who helps you that day may not be there, and that also leads to sort of a decline in the product knowledge and awareness of what they're selling. So,
so what's the fix? I mean, what do the auditors recommend?
Well, you know, additional training and hiring a consultant to kind of come in and make sure that from a business perspective, you know, somebody with a business background, business consulting background, that they can come in and look at it and make sure that the way it's operating is operating like a business, which is sort of the goal, and not sort of this quasi state run governmental proto business entity that it is, you know. and so there the Sal Patios, who's the director of the agency, has said that they're going to kind of move in that direction and agreed that they could do more to make sure that it is run like a business.
As Robert mentioned, Senator Karen Maine wants answers. Paul Raleigh, do you think the legislature is inclined to act as a whole? I mean, either by having a public process or an extended conversation about either privatization or some sort of overhaul.
Yeah, the legislature, they might do some Band-Aid things. I mean, you know, I'll predict that maybe 3-4 years down the road, we're going to have another audit pointing out all the problems with the DABC, different problems maybe than now. I mean, we seem to have these audits every few years, and they always point out how poorly run the DABC is and all the problems that it has, and it never really gets fixed. And I think it's because there's a philosophical issue at the legislature where, you know, you're never going to have it go, you know, privatized, I don't think. Derek Brown, the former legislator and now works for Mike Lee, actually, you know, when they were talking about problems with the ABC a couple of years ago when he was in the legislature in a committee, he brought up the question, why are we even in this business, you know,
That was actually Ryan Wilcox, who also works for Mike
Lee. Well,
you know?
Derek Brown also said it, too.
Oh, okay.
In a different committee meeting I was sitting in, but okay. It was a business labor committee. It was 2-3 years ago, but people brought there are individual legislators who bring up this question, I think you're always going to have problems because you've got a mentality that there needs to be. You've got, first of all, you've got a retail business, and then that's the government wants to run, and that's always not going to work very well, particularly when you got a philosophical issue of basically looking at this business as evil. And the employees, you know, not only are they poorly paid, and most of them, they have a ratio. They only will allow so many full-time people work in the liquor stores. Most of them have to be part-time, so they don't have to pay benefits. But not only do you have that issue leading to a turnover, is the employees themselves feel like they're not trusted, the administrators view them as crooks or incompetent or bad. I mean, that's how they feel. And there was an op-ed piece by Francine Gianni, who for a while was the acting director of DABC, defending the current administration from, you know, from these attacks by, you know, Karen Main and criticisms from her and others. And she basically said she was defending this new ordering system that they have rather than being ordered by the store managers. And she, her argument was you can't trust the store managers because they're going to make side deals with certain distributors and get paid on the side. And so basically these store managers look at an op-ed like that and they say, you know, they just think we're all crooks.
One other thing that I was probably should have mentioned that was in the audit is it looked at package agencies, which is sort of these small, you know, the, for places where there's not a state liquor store, they're privately contracted with the state. And one of the things they found is that they're not tracking sort of the collections of the revenues from these places, which is becomes an issue because several years ago there was a package agency, I believe in Eden, that that had a huge problem with money that was just never paid, and then the state had to go, you know, shut it down and try to collect the money. So that's a that's an sort of a lingering problem. One thing Paul mentioned is sort of this privatization concept, and that is an issue that's been floating around the Capitol Hill for probably decades now at this point, but, well, not decades, but the Representative Wilcox, who just a couple years ago was actually talking about legislation to try to privatize these things, is, you know, it's sort of a, an issue that, especially in the House, where there's sort of a more of a libertarian bent to their conservatism, actually has a fair amount of support. It was just always sort of the Senate is pretty pretty reluctant to do that. So, you know, I don't know if it's something that's going to happen in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, but there is sort of, I think, a warming to the concept that maybe the state shouldn't actually be running these liquor stores and we should, you know, be looking at ways that we can control the inventory on sort of the warehouse and distribution side, but then let the privatize the retail outlets.
Well, they do have this, sort of this schizophrenic identity. They are retailers, but they're also regulators, which is troublesome.
And we're trafficking in something that, you know, the state generally does not want to encourage consumption of. So, I mean, that's sort of their stated policy. We don't want to encourage consumption. So, you know, they're conflicted in that way too.
But it likes the revenue.
They love the revenue.
I love the revenue. Scrutiny continues. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. We need to take a break. You can join us too. 801-355-TALK is our number. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pearson. Today in studio, Rebecca Walsh, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and Paul Raleigh are here. And you can join us by tweeting to the hashtag TribTalk or calling 801-355-TALK. Robert, let's turn to the death penalty. We go from liquor to the death penalty. Wow, it's getting darker in here. A Utah lawmaker is floating an idea to add to the list of capital crimes. Tell us about this.
Well, Representative Paul Ray has kind of floated this idea before. He's got legislation drafted now that would make aggravated child sex trafficking a capital offense. So you could be punished with, you could be executed for doing it. His argument is that, you know, we want to make a clear, you know, clear statement that in Utah we don't tolerate this, that it's a heinous act, and that, you know, if we execute people for things like treason and you know, then we should also be able to execute them for exploiting children for, you know, sex trafficking.
How often is this happening in Utah? How often are Utahns convicted of child sex trafficking?
That's an excellent question. I don't have a good answer for you on that, I'm afraid. But he said it's happening. He said it's a problem, and he said he's been on vice stings where, not necessarily to break up sex trafficking rings, but where he's seen sort of the consequences, I guess, of this child exploitation. And so he's going to pursue this. He's trying to get it into an interim meeting during the summer, and so it's ready to go in January. It's going to spark a pretty vigorous debate, I think, because you've got groups on the other side, ACLU and the Libertas Institute and others who say that, you know, we shouldn't be expanding the death penalty. We have we have a problem with the death penalty as it is, because one of the bills that Representative Ray sponsored this past session brings back the firing squad as a sort of a backup plan in case we can't do lethal injection in the state, because there's this issue with getting the drugs that they use for the lethal injection. So Representative Ray's bill this past session was, okay, well, if we can't get the drugs for lethal injection, we'll go to the firing squad. Well, you know, if the groups are saying, well, if we can't execute people humanely, or, you know, if there is a humane way to execute people, then why are we trying to then expand it to this whole other class of crimes that are, you know, and it also raises constitutional issues. There was a Supreme Court case, I believe, in 2008. It was Kennedy versus Louisiana, where they said, in the case there was aggravated rape or repeated rape of a child, I guess, it was punishable by death. And the court said, you know, in cases where there's not a life taken, you know, to take a life is a violation of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. So that would be a big hurdle to overcome if Representative Ray's bill did come to the legislature and pass. It would almost certainly invite a lawsuit.
What are the chances?
What are the chances of it passing? Well, I think it's a pretty heavy lift, because I do think that there's, you know, a recognition that this would be this would invite the litigation. The question you asked about how frequent does this occur, I think, is one that will certainly be on the table. But you also get a situation where you don't want to be a representative, in, you know, going into an election year voting against, you know, punishing sex traffickers. So that dynamic could come into play as well. And there's also going to be sort of the larger discussion. One of the things that came up during the firing squad debate during the session was that they wanted to have sort of a larger discussion of the issues surrounding the death penalty in the state. Is it a deterrent? Is it, you know, is it effective? Is it cost effective? The ACLU and Libertas and some of the other groups say that it's not cost effective. It's not a deterrent. It, you know, it doesn't bring closure to the victims, and it's not something that we should be expanding in the state.
It's interesting that this proposal came here in Utah the same week that Nebraska voted to abolish the death penalty. And so it is sort of bucking the national trend.
Right. And Nebraska was just sort of the latest. Washington State, the governor up there, had suspended executions. Other states have kind of said until they can figure out some of the issues surrounding the executions, they're going to kind of take it slow. So, yeah, but, you know, the death penalty in Utah, I think, is sort of a time-honored tradition in a lot of ways. I mean, it's almost tied to our history and culture with Gary Gilmore and sort of the history of that. So, you know, it is an issue that I don't think certainly not the legislature isn't going to be moving in the direction of abolishing it like Nebraska did necessarily anytime soon. But I also don't know if they have the stomach to expand it right now.
Raleigh, from the opinion page, do you agree?
Well, it'll bring a lot of attention to Utah again, like the firing squad bill did. Not necessarily welcome attention, you know, nationally or internationally, or, you know, like Kurt Oda's bill a few years ago, where he wanted to go kill all the feral cats and that sort of thing. But, you know, Utah, our legislature seems to have a tendency to do things that bring a lot of attention to us, and give some good material to the David Lettermans of the world, and you know, and the John, the Daily Shows, and that sort of thing. But I don't see that passing. I mean, it's got the same. They're still ignoring some of the basic problems that I see with the death penalty, and that is the arbitrary nature of it, and the shining example of that is the Lafferty's. Dan and Ron Lafferty committed the same crime together. They both, Ron killed the mother and Dan killed the small infant child. And they had different trials. Ron got the death penalty and Dan didn't get the death penalty because one juror down in Utah County believed his story that God told him to do it. So you gotta do what God tells you, right? So. That's to me a big problem, is how arbitrary it is. And then what happens when, you know, you execute somebody and then later you find out you got the wrong person, because that's final. You can't reverse anything. But I frankly don't see the legislature passing it. I agree with Robert. I don't think they've got the stomach to go that far.
Well, I have to get a dig into Representative Ray because he was scheduled to appear on our Trib Talk video show and he did not show up.
Not a
cool thing
to
do.
Well, that should be punishable by death, too.
I agree. Let's move on to the BLM. Rebecca, a federal judge this week ruled that the BLM has 3 years to determine what a road is, I guess. Fill in the details of this decision.
Or what a road will do.
Right.
There were a series of resource management plans passed for federal lands in the waning days of the Bush administration in 2008, and this Richfield resource management plan was one of those. The BLM was sued by environmental groups. U.S. District Court Judge Dale Kimball ruled in 2013 that the BLM had not done sufficient analysis of more than 4,000 miles of ATV routes to determine how they would have impacted archaeological sites. The BLM has said, we don't have enough staff to do this, we can't do this. The judge says, that's too bad, you need to figure out how to do this. You've got 3 years to come back with a better analysis of these roads.
And environmentalists consider this a huge victory.
They do. They're happy that the BLM will be forced to do this sort of analysis, which is required as part of the RMP process. And it may trickle down. There's, I think, several dozen, if not 100, of these RMPs that were passed at the end of the Bush administration. So they feel like this judge is sort of holding federal land managers to the requirements of the law that exists today.
What's the broader impact of this decision? What does it mean?
Well, for this region of Utah, which is Sevier, Garfield, Wayne, and Paiute counties, it's the area between Capitol Reef and Canyonlands National Parks, it may have significant impact on these roads, and some of these may cross over into RS-2477 challenges. Some of these counties want to declare these historic roads so that they can pursue development along them. Environmentalists would say that these are trails that should not be allowed to be developed. So the BLM will have to lay down road by road what they think about what the resources are along those roads.
But certainly the decision this week does not settle the question. It's not over. How has the BLM responded?
BLM says, well, we'll do what we have to do, but we have limited resources. The judge said, you have 3 years.
Okay, we'll continue to follow that story. Also down in rural Utah, allies of a San Juan County commissioner want to find a way to help pay his legal bills. And before we get to the need for funds, remind our listeners who Phil Lyman is and what did he do?
Phil Lyman is the San Juan County commissioner who, in the wake of the Clive and Bundy protest down in Nevada, decided that he would like his own protest and decided to lead a rally, an ATV rally, up a sensitive wash/trail/canyon called Recapture Canyon in San Juan County. Then he thought better of it and sort of said, well, you need to stay on the trail and you should stop at this point. Some of the people on the ride continued past that. The BLM was there taking pictures and took down license plates and charged originally 5, taken down to 4 men from San Juan County for conspiracy in relationship to that protest last May. Earlier this month, Lyman and another San Juan County man were convicted on the conspiracy charges. 2 other men were acquitted. Lyman and this other defendant are expected to appeal. In the meantime, he's racked up a pretty hefty legal bill. When he was first charged, he asked for a federal public defender. And then a judge said, wait a minute, you have enough resources. I don't think the federal taxpayer should be on the hook for this. You need to reimburse us. Then he hired a private attorney. And we have not heard yet an estimate of how much his legal bills are. But because of the conviction, he faces up to a year in jail and a fine of $100,000 plus more than $100,000 in restitution for damage to the trail. So this could potentially be a $200,000, $300,000 bill. We don't know yet.
He has friends, though.
He does have friends.
Who are proposing that they do chip in a little bit and help pay those attorney's fees. What's the plan?
Well, apparently there is a core group of supporters in San Juan County, and about 100 to 200 of them showed up at a San Juan County Commission meeting on May 19th and browbeat members of the commission and said, you guys need to stand behind him. We need to pay for his legal bills. So the most that the commission would do is pass a resolution saying Phil Lyman deserves his due process in relationship to this protest. And the commissioners understood that that resolution would be used by Representative Mike Noel to take the case to the Constitutional Defense Council when they next meet to say, hey, the state should pay for Phil Lyman's legal bills, because he was representing all of us.
And remind me again, my memory is a little hazy, but did the state pay for Tim Christopher's defense?
I don't think so. And there isn't a legal precedent for this. Okay. There's some question about whether or not any individual could ask for the state to pay their legal bills.
Okay.
So, no, I think private donors paid for Tim Christopher's, right. And some of it was pro bono.
And one of the most vocal allies for this this proposal is Representative Mike Noel, who, a Republican of Kanab. And Paul, he's shown up in your column a time or two.
He's actually going to show up in my column tomorrow.
Oh, excellent.
But,
what's interesting, Robert mentioned Tim DeChristopher. For some reason, somebody sent an email to Noel and some others blasting the idea that the public pay for this guy's defense. Or his appeals, excuse me, and for some reason copied me on the email. So now I've been getting all the responses back and forth. And it's interesting that the same people who think that the public should pay for his appeals and everything else so he can get a fair trial and he's being railroaded and everything else are the same people who thought wanted the book thrown at Tim DeChristopher. And for also doing a protest and everything else. And he was bad, he was evil, he needed to go to prison. And Lyman is, he's a hero, and we need to pay for his defense. And it's also interesting that most these people are conservative, of course, a small government people who are always complaining about spending taxpayer money and that sort of thing. They want the taxpayers to pay for Lyman's appeals. And it was interesting where DeChristopher represented a more liberal base they raised money privately to pay for his defense. So I find that rather ironic that the anti-tax people want taxes to pay for one of their guys. I feel that Lyman knew what he was getting into when he did it, and now he doesn't. Now he wants the public to pay for his consequences, the whole thing is ironic. And Mike Noel is a perfect example of because he was one of the most vocal people saying that Tim DeChristopher should. Be punished to the full extent of the law because Tim DeChristopher represents a view that he doesn't agree with, but Lyman does.
I think it should also be noted that Mike Noel led his own rally or rallied troops to ride up the Paria River in 2009 and was never charged by a U.S. attorney at the time, Brett Tolman.
Mm-hmm.
So he himself has been involved in one of these protest riots and was never faced the consequences of that.
But who decides if Lyman's defense is worthy of taxpayer dollars?
Well, if they take it to the Constitutional Defense Council, it's a committee of lawmakers and attorneys. I'm not sure what the urban-rural split is on that anymore, but it's the Constitutional Defense Council was created to sort of fight these public lands fights, to work on litigation, and to help decide how to spend money for the state on these issues. So they may be able to try to make this argument that this is a public lands fight for the state of Utah. Whether or not they can defend one individual related to that fight is the question.
Yeah, we'll continue to follow that story pretty closely. Let's move on to education. And there's a great piece in today's paper. Is it today's paper?
I can't remember.
It's all running together.
Today's
paper on State School Superintendent Brad Smith. He is prone to stirring the pot. He's done it once again. What did he say during an address to the Utah Taxpayers Association yesterday?
He's racking up a greatest hits list. So the first point he made was that we should just have faith in public education and, by extension, in Brad Smith to be able to save public education. The second point he made was that there's no particular virtue in trying to rise from the bottom of the heap in terms of how much we spend per pupil in Utah. There's no particular vice to being number 50. The most important thing is how our students are doing on their tests. And that's what he's going to focus on, not how much money we spend, but how those kids do on the tests. And he was sort of preaching to the choir in the form of the Utah Taxpayers Association. The question may be for educators, who is he really representing here? Is he representing kids or is he representing business interests and taxpayers?
And he's made controversial comments before. He had a gaffe during the legislative session recently.
Yes, there was a protest toward the end of the session where teachers, I don't remember, was it 500 or 1,000 showed up at the Capitol?
How many showed up? It was a big protest. It was a couple thousand.
Yeah. Showed up to say, hey, we want more money per pupil spending. And he criticized that yesterday as well, saying, I don't want generic requests for funding. I want specific requests. So I suppose he would argue, if you have a tech initiative and you want to buy computers, give us a dollar amount. But if you just want more general funding for education, don't ask for that.
Well, and I was surprised by that comment, too, because they were very specific. They wanted 6.5%. That was they wanted.
But that's general funding.
That's general funding. Yes. But that's the WPU. That's how all of these
how
programs
pay
end
for
up
students.
Getting funded. And he
yes.
knows that as well as anybody
yes.
else.
Yes.
But and I think he said they were acting like spoiled children who didn't get what they wanted on Christmas.
On Christmas. And he apologized. And then he had to post something on Facebook. And he's sort of fallen on his sword for that comment. And then he comes back to the Utah Taxpayers Association and essentially says some of the same stuff. So I think teachers are kind of feeling whiplash. Where does this guy stand? Is he backing us up? Is he just caught up in the moment? Or is this his personal philosophy toward education?
Well, Rebecca, you just have to have faith. Sorry.
That's
just
what he told us yesterday.
Have
faith.
Okay, we're talking about the week's news, and again, you can chime in. 801-355-TALK is that number. Put your comments at sltrib.com. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We need to take another quick break. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. We're talking about the week's news. And again, joining me in studio, Tribune staffers Rebecca Walsh, Paul Raleigh, Robert Gerke, and Matt Canham. Before we get to our final segment, the underplayed story, Rebecca, another interesting piece by our higher ed reporter, Annie Knox, which talked about a lack of research funding at higher ed institutions. What's the story there?
And it seems to be medical schools in particular. The University of Utah Medical School Dean Vivian Lee joined about 24 other medical school deans across the country writing a sort of a political advocacy research piece for a science journal saying, basically, we need more federal funding for biomedical research or we're going to be in trouble. They would like an increase of 4.6%. Vivian Lee told us that at the University of Utah, they've had a drop of 5% in National Institutes of Health research funding since 2010. She said that some of their researchers are going back to China and India to work because they feel like the opportunities are better in those places than they are here. So they're making the argument that we're going to have a brain drain if something doesn't change quickly.
Hmm. And who are they appealing to?
I think they're appealing to Congress. I think they may also be appealing to state legislatures. They've lost funding for research, sort of institutional funding for research across the board since the downturn in the economy, and it just hasn't recovered.
Okay, that's something that we'll continue to watch as well. Okay, our final segment, the underplayed story of the week, the story that may not have gotten a lot of ground this week, but will live on and build. And Matt Canham, let's go to you first. What's your pick?
Anthrax. We had the military, the Pentagon announced this week, Dugway Proving Grounds here in Utah mistakenly sent live anthrax samples to potentially 9 sites across the nation. They did it using commercial shipping.
Oops.
So next year, you know, care package from your mom could have been live anthrax.
And South Korea, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure North Korea loves that.
Yes. Now, this is obviously going to be a story that is followed not just in Utah, but nationally and internationally for a while here to figure out what happened. And what it appears, at least this morning, is that it's not like there was an employee there who made a mistake. It's that these samples were supposed to be neutralized, and the process to neutralize them somehow didn't happen. but it wasn't that someone at Dugway screwed up and put the wrong box on a truck. But this is something that we obviously, as a country, want to figure out so we don't put live anthrax in some FedEx or UPS truck and send it across the nation.
Absolutely. And if you want to know what goes on at Dugway Proving Ground, there's a great piece in this morning's paper by our colleague Nate Carlisle who fills us in. So take a look at that. All right, Rebecca Walsh.
I am going to pitch an education story by Annie Knox about the a quiet tweak to state law to allow universities to give private scholarships to undocumented students. We only have about 1,000 kids, apparently, at Utah schools who are undocumented, but they haven't been able to get funding, private funding or public funding, from their university since 2008 when Utah passed its immigration law. This quiet change will allow the universities to funnel public or private donations to some of these students to help them pay for college.
That's a great story. And again, if you haven't seen these stories, go to sltrib.com. Paul Raleigh, what's your pick today?
Well, I'll talk about an item I had in my column today, and that is after all the problems that Salt Lake City has had with their parking kiosks and that with their new kiosk that they got a few years ago, and they had glitch after glitch after glitch and all sorts of complaints, and then a few months ago, Ralph Becker had a press conference announcing this new system, and they've got a new vendor, and they've cleaned everything up. And everything's going to be really good now, and that turns out that they've been violating federal law for the last, ever since these new kiosks have come in, because when you put your credit card in the kiosk, the receipt that comes out has your first six numbers on your credit card, and then
it does.
Yeah, and then it has.
I got to check that out.
Well, you haven't read my column yet today, obviously.
Apparently,
and then. And then it has, you know, four that are blocked out, and then the last four. So you've got 10 numbers on your credit card that show up on the account, which is against a violation of a federal law that put in place in 2003, to protect against identity theft. And the federal law says you can't have on the receipts more than five numbers on your credit card on the receipt. So a reader actually pointed that out to me, and then I went down and put my credit card in a kiosk just to see for myself, and then I called the city, after I called the city and they looked into it and they figured out, yeah, we're violating federal law. So they've fixed it now.
Okay, that's Paul Raleigh's column at sltrib.com. Robert, what's your pick?
I think my pick is that I need to go out to the parking meter and pull that receipt out.
Yeah.
I was just going to point out that there's a lawsuit that's going to be filed against the Salt Lake Police Department by three female police officers who claimed that the former deputy police chief, Rick Findlay, had sexually harassed them over a period of time. And it's kind of a big deal just because, I mean, this is, you know, a large department. I think there's a sense that, you know, that the police officers need to sort of represent the community. And so, you know, getting women in there is important. But it is, obviously, they're alleging that it created a hostile work environment for them, and they're going to be suing the city.
And my prediction is it's mayoral election time. So it probably will be a campaign issue. My underplayed story concerns you, Matt Canham. You've got a new book coming out this next week. I believe it actually is available at a bookstore near you on Tuesday. Is that
right?
That's right. Okay, tell us about it.
So my colleague and close friend Thomas Burr and I have spent 18 months digging into the relationship between the Romneys and the Huntsmans. And what started out as a very friendly and politically advantageous relationship is now... they are now adversaries, and they are rivals. And so the story kind of tracks their family histories and how they've clashed and came together over time.
And it looks like an intriguing book. You and Tommy are going to be on this show next week.
That's right.
To talk about it a little bit more in depth. But looking forward to that. And again, you can find out more at MormonRivals.com.
We'll have a story in Sunday's paper. The book will be available on Tuesday at all the bookstores in the state. So
okay.
Go buy local.
Congratulations, Matt. Matt Canham, Rebecca Walsh, Paul Raleigh, Robert Gerke, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody, so much for your time.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You.
You
Thanks.
Too.
Thank you.
And we'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks about how much he hates to move.
To moving because I was raised in the military. And we lived, it seems like we moved every other year. And so moving wasn't a big deal to me until I realized that it was mostly on me because I had girls, my wife and I. We didn't have any sons. So all the heavy stuff was lifted by me. Not anymore, though. They're all married.
Pass that along down to the next generation, right?
Right.
You wrote about moving in a column back in 2004. Set it up for us.
It was Memorial Day weekend, and my daughter and her husband decided that they were going to sell their house, and it sold, and they had to be out of it right away. And so they were moving in with us. We have an apartment in our home, which is where I go when my wife banishes me. But our kids have all used it from time to time, and so I was helping them move. And I wrote in this column, between the five members of our family, this is our 39th move. We are experts in the art of dinging furniture, confusing pets, and arranging for utilities to get shut off too early. Over the years, the moving process naturally divided into two equal but politically incorrect parts, packing and lugging. The women pack the boxes, and the men, just me in the early days, drag them out of the house and lash them onto a vehicle. I once got our entire household into and onto a 1977 Mercury station wagon with 400 feet of rope, two bungee cords, and some scotch tape. It looked like something straight out of the Grapes of Wrath, but it worked. My wife is no less gifted. She can get the contents of an overstuffed five-drawer bureau into a 13-gallon garbage bag without wrinkling a single item.
You're done with this, though. This
yeah.
is this phase of life. You're done breaking your back.
That's right. Everything from here on, it's all downsizing. And hopefully my next move will be into a rest home.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Again, you can read a lot more Kirby at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks so much to Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening and have a great weekend.